It's here and now. As Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg lies in repose at the Supreme Court, we're hearing how mothers are coming with daughters to pay respects, little girls dressed in black with white lacy collars. I'm thinking of my mother, who by law in the 60s couldn't get her own credit card, or me signing a contract in the 70s that said I couldn't get pregnant or otherwise disfigured. How is it no one took this gender discrimination on the way she did? Well, for one thing, there were laws in some parts banning women from being lawyers. For another, she was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Jonathan Enten was her legal clerk in the 1980s when she was on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit Court. He's now a professor emeritus of law and adjunct professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. He joins us on Skype. And Jonathan, we are just so sorry for your personal loss.
Well, thank you. The clerks were all part of Justice Ginsburg's family, and she was really part of our family. But I think the loss is not personal so much as it is institutional for the court and just for the entire country.
Yeah. We know that many clerks are in Washington, D.C., and there was, over 100 of them lining the steps of the Supreme Court to receive her casket. What did you think when you saw that?
I was just completely blown away. I'm not a sentimental person, but it was really hard to keep things together.
Yeah, it's quite a club, to belong to. Do you remember your first impression?
Let's back up. I applied to her because of what she had done before she was nominated to the D.C. Circuit. She was the architect of a litigation campaign that resulted in a series of landmark Supreme Court rulings prohibiting gender discrimination.
Well, let's remind people. Take us through some of those seemingly ridiculous now early laws. For instance, in 1873, Illinois was allowed to ban women from becoming lawyers because they were too fragile, and also because the creator deemed that their paramount destiny and mission was to fulfill the noble and benign offices of wife and mother. This was the law. Then you go to 1908, an Oregon law limited the number of hours that women could work, not men, women, and it relied on Louis Brandeis, a familiar name, to support this notion that women needed protection to avoid harming their reproductive function.
Right. One thing we should say about Brandeis, he made this argument in part, I think, because of other Supreme Court decisions that said that states generally could not limit the working hours of anybody. Brandeis was outraged by those decisions, and in some ways, he was looking for a way to chip away at those rulings. But in doing so, he made an argument that bought into the stereotype that women were too fragile to get out in the real world and work. And that meant that women had many fewer opportunities than men did.
Right. Well, it's in this kind of pool that she dives. And you write, she starts with a case, Reed versus Reed. It challenged an Idaho law that required probate courts to appoint men to administer estates, even if there was a qualified woman. And it was the case of a couple named Reed, long divorced, very sad to me. Their teenage son had committed suicide. Both the parents wanted to administer his tiny little estate, and the judge appointed the father because that was required by state law. And this got appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. Ginsburg didn't argue this case, but wrote the brief. I mean, there it is right there. That is not equal under the law.
That's right. Reed, in one sense, is a small case, but then Professor Ginsburg understood that this kind of small-looking case could be the opportunity to make some good law. And in fact, that's what happened. The court said that this kind of gender-based law was unconstitutional. The court had never, ever found any gender-based law to be unconstitutional in its entire history. That was a breakthrough.
Talk a little bit about how early on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and this, others have mentioned this, but she understood that when She was fighting gender discrimination. That fight included men as well. So there were widowers who were challenging the Social Security Act provision that gave benefits only to widows who automatically received survivors' benefits, not to widowers.
That's right. And Justice Ginsburg understood that laws that restricted women's opportunities also affected men. Now, she understood this just at a very basic level, in part because she had a wonderfully supportive husband, Martin Ginsburg.
Marty.
They met in college, and Marty was her biggest booster for his entire life. But she also was a very good lawyer, a brilliant lawyer. She knew that when she was going to the Supreme Court, she knew that she was talking to a group of 9 middle-aged and older men. And so she thought, I need to persuade these folks that I've got a serious legal argument. What better way to do that than by showing them that assumptions about what was a male function and what was a female function might influence them as well?
Talk a little bit about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's first appearance before the Supreme Court as a lawyer. And she was appearing on behalf of Air Force Lieutenant Sharon Frontiero, who was required by law to prove that her husband was dependent on her for at least half his support in order for her to get housing, medical and dental benefits. A male person in the military did not have to do that. You talked to her about that. What?
Right.
Just give us one thing that she told you that was eye-opening for you.
The most significant thing she said was she had never argued at the Supreme Court. She had done a few arguments in lower courts. She was really nervous. But when she got to the lectern and began the argument, she said she felt a jolt of energy. And she got 4 justices to say that the court should use the same legal standard for evaluating gender-based classifications as it did for evaluating race-based classifications, which is to say they're almost always invalid. But for several of the justices, the analogy to racial discrimination was a step too far. So she took these cases incrementally to try to expand on the legal doctrine that she was trying to get the court to endorse.
Jonathan Enten, you go on to be a clerk for her now when she's an appeals court judge. Give us one thing that has made you different because of having done that.
I can't think of one thing that's different. There's so many things that are different. I would not be the person I am. I would not have had the career that I've had without having been part of Justice Ginsburg's judicial family. I do not have words to say how important that has been to me. But I also want to say one other thing about Justice Ginsburg. If she had never been on the Supreme Court, she would have been a person of enormous historic significance, precisely because of the things that you and I have been talking about in this conversation. But these days, that's not how you get on the Supreme Court. You get on the Supreme Court by being perceived by whichever party as being right on the issues that matter. And it doesn't give you the opportunity to do other things. So the loss of Justice Ginsburg is not just the loss of a jurist of historic stature, as Chief Justice Roberts has put it. In a way, we've seen the last of an era in the kinds of people who wind up on the Supreme Court. And I think that's a loss for the court, and I think it's a loss for the country.
Jonathan Enten, Professor Emeritus of Law and Adjunct Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. But I think the title he'd really like us to mention today is Once a Clerk for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Jonathan, thank you so much for your reflections today.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now.